So I think you can learn a lot from these documents, and it's pretty clear that the principles that they outlined, even though they certainly evolved, they changed with time, but that's a lot of the basic principles have remained continuous throughout different stages in the post-war period, in the Cold War and post-Cold War period. And that within the Middle East region, that had a specific implication, which was control of Middle Eastern resources. Grand Area Strategy spoke specifically about controlling specific parts of the world to ensure US preeminence. Parts of Asia, parts of Africa, parts of the Middle East. It spoke about the need to control these regions, especially due to their populations and their resources and their geographic locations.
We have all bound ourselves to work together to make sure that there is increasing happiness and prosperity for the broad masses of the people in every land, no longer subject to the hard strains of war.
A few months later, in Fulton, Missouri, on the 8th of March, 1946.
An iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe.
In the background was the growing struggle between two great powers to shape the post-war world. Already an iron curtain had dropped around Poland, Hungary, Yugoslavia, Bulgaria.
Noam Chomsky.
What about Soviet imperialism after the Second World War? That was real, but it was narrow. If you take a look at interventions after the Second World War, the Soviet Union did intervene in East Berlin, in Hungary, in Czechoslovakia, Poland, within Eastern Europe. That was their domain. They wanted to be left alone to run their own dungeon in their own domain. For the U.S., it was the rest of the world. You take a look at U.S. interventions all over the place. And the idea is, okay, we run the world, and there's a kind of like a tacit compact. We'll kind of shout at each other.
Stay out of this hemisphere, and don't try to start your plans and your conspiracies over here.
But each of us will discipline our own domains. For Russia, Eastern Europe, for the U.S., the world. And take a look at the history of the Cold War, that's what it was. It was wars against independent countries by the superpowers, almost all the U.S., because our domain is the world.
One of the most revealing passages in Churchill's memoirs describes an exchange between himself and Stalin, when the two warlords carved up the political boundaries of Europe, not on official policy documents, but a half sheet of paper. "The moment was apt for business," Churchill wrote. "So I said to Stalin, 'Let us settle about our affairs in the Balkans. Your armies are in Romania and Bulgaria. How would it do for you to have 90% predominance in Romania, for us to have 90% of the say in Greece, and go 50-50 about Yugoslavia?' Stalin agreed and kept his word. Following World War II, the United States began funneling huge sums of money to its European allies in what became known as the Marshall Plan. The purpose was twofold: to help European nations rebuild their shattered economies, and to dissuade their populations from embracing communism, socialism, or any path independent of the United States. The aid provided essential relief for the war-ravaged countries of Europe. Yet, in the years between 1952 and 1962, of the $50 billion given to 90 separate countries by the United States, only $5 billion was for non-military economic support.
George Elsey, aide to President Truman.
It was a desirable step to persuade the world that we really were being altruistic here. This was not basically an anti-communist, anti-Soviet measure.
The first major test in establishing America's commitment to real democracy would come from Greece. During the war, the left-wing National Liberation Front had provided the majority of resistance to the Nazis. It also set up interim governments across the nation. Though its military leadership was communist, the partisan governments bore no resemblance to Stalinist Russia. They were decentralized and participatory.
From the 1986 film, Greece, the Hidden War.
In April, it set up a provisional government in the mountains. Elections were held, and women were given the vote for the first time.
I remember that the government made beautiful things happen, and we were raised to a higher level. The other governments had neglected the peasants. Beautiful things happened, like voting. I voted, and we helped in the local government in any way we could.
Η αλληλοεξάρτηση και η κατανόηση που είχε δημιουργηθεί.
The solidarity and understanding that were generated up here in the mountains and the enthusiasm for self-government made people so much more aware and sophisticated that those of us who came up from Athens just couldn't believe it.
Πάντως ο κόσμος έμενε πολύ ευχαριστημένος από το...
In general, the people were very pleased with this people's government. We had general assemblies every month, and every villager could air his grievances and criticize the chairman or councillor when he didn't do his duty. We made decisions for the whole village. Whatever happened in the village, everyone had to know about it. That was how self-government worked.
When we started to govern ourselves, we got encouraged, and people woke up, so to speak. We became more active and took more responsibility for ourselves.
We wanted this government to agree to the separation of church and state, and that priests should complete secondary school and have theological degrees. In the meantime, we joined the resistance, and the churches contributed however they could.
Winston Churchill described the situation as anarchy and demanded a return of King George II. When the people of Greece rejected the return of the monarchy, the British army attacked.
Eam's goal was to make Greece independent, free from all ties. We knew from the start that the British wanted to keep Greece within their sphere of influence in the Mediterranean for their own political ends. Eam was opposed to this, and so the British were against us from the start.
The British and the Greek governments, along with the royalist troops, wanted to restore the old order in Greece. They wanted the king back on his throne because he was the best guarantee of British interests in Greece, political, economic and strategic.
People hated the dictatorship of Metaxas and the king. Together they oppressed the Greek people. We didn't want in any way to go back to the same tyrannical regime which was supported from abroad after the liberation. That regime was hated by all Greeks.
A network of concentration camps were set up across the Greek islands, while right-wing death squads terrorized villages. A favorite technique was beheading. President Truman responded by giving hundreds of millions of dollars in military aid to the very men the Allies had been fighting just months before.
The free peoples of the world look to us for support in maintaining their freedoms. If we falter in our leadership, we may endanger the peace of the world, and we shall surely endanger the welfare of this nation. I therefore ask the Congress to provide authority for assistance to Greece and Turkey in the amount of $400 million for the period ending June 30th, 1948.
In 1947, 74,000 tons of military equipment were sent to Greece. Among the supplies were hundreds of mules. Less amusing were the massive stocks of napalm. During the Greek Civil War, Churchill praised Stalin for adhering strictly and faithfully to our agreement of October. During all the long weeks of fighting the communists in the streets of Athens, not one word of reproach came from Pravda or Izvestia.
There were many fears. The primary fears were the usual ones. The British invaded Greece in 1944 and tried to restore it to the British imperial system. It was then declining. The U.S. was taking it over. Greece, there was a strong anti-Nazi resistance. It had pretty much liberated the country from the Nazis. And it was what's called communist. It was peasant and worker-based. All over Europe, there was, in the wake of the war, there was a kind of a radical democracy, often called communist or socialist or something like that. And the U.S. didn't want that. It wanted to restore the traditional order. So in Greece, after the British could no longer control the resistance, they pulled out. The United States moved in. That's when the Truman Doctrine was announced in lofty rhetoric about defending democracy. But in fact, it was to crush the anti-Nazi resistance, peasant worker-based anti-Nazi resistance, and to restore the traditional order with many fascist collaborators and so on. They didn't care about that, which is exactly what happened. It killed maybe 150,000 Greeks and set Greece on the path that followed. Later, it turned out that it wasn't enough, so the U.S. supported openly the first direct revival of fascism in Europe, not hidden. The fascist generals were supported by the United States when they took over in the 60s, and that lasted until 1974, I think, when there was an uprising which threw them out. Well, okay, that's Greece. Italy. Italy has been the target of more CIA action than anywhere else in the world, as far as the record shows, up until at least the 1970s. At that point, the record runs dry. In Italy, there was a very powerful left. And if there had been free elections, the left would have won. And the U.S. was very much frightened of that. And in fact, go back a little bit. Italy was the first place where U.S. and British troops landed on the continent. 1943, they landed in Sicily, then started moving up the peninsula. And they had a problem. The Nazis had pretty much were being driven from Italy, as in Greece, by the resistance, by the popular resistance. So as the U.S. and British forces came in, they had to crush the resistance and reinstate the fascists, which is exactly what they did. So Field Marshal Badoglio, great fascist hero, conqueror of Abyssinia, he was installed as prime minister, and the king, the pro-fascist king, was brought back, especially as the troops went to the north. The north had already been liberated by the resistance. Nazis pretty much driven out. They'd established a functioning society with worker-owned factories, driving out managers and so on. The United States was horrified. And the British, and remember, it was the Labour Party then, they were even more horrified. The idea of driving managers out of factories and running it yourself, I mean, utter anathema. So the liberated society of northern Italy had to be crushed, and the traditional forces reinstituted, including, of course, leading fascists. And in fact, this was done all through Europe, but the most important places were Italy and Greece, because it had advanced farther then. Now, Italy and Greece were both understood to be part of the system of controlling Middle East oil. The transit lines went through the Mediterranean, so that's all one big system, you know, of which this is one component, and the U.S. was not going to sacrifice that. The control of Middle East oil was regarded as an absolutely central part of post-war global planning, and of course, control over Europe. Now, there were other aspects, too. The formation of NATO, for example, was theoretically motivated by concern that Russia will invade. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, but it was also driven by the concern that Europe might move in an independent path. I mean, Europe's a big place. It's got an economy the scale of the United States, more advanced than the United States in many respects. It had been crushed by the war, but it was going to reindustrialize, and it did over the next couple of decades, and became a flourishing economy. Well, there's always a concern that it might strike out on its own. It might become what was called a third force, independent of the United States and Russia. It may be along Gaullist lines. You know, de Gaulle had this plan of a Europe from the Atlantic to the Urals as a separate force in world affairs. It's anathema to U.S. planners.
The embrace of fascist leaders by the West is often explained as a product of Cold War necessity, yet the reality is more complex. From the very beginning of the fascist movement, many Western business leaders not only praised fascists, but offered significant financial, intellectual, and moral support. The case of Spain provides one of the most striking examples. When peasants and workers took control of production, consumption, and social life across much of the country, world leaders united in opposition against them. Their system of self-government threatened not only the fascists and Stalinists, but liberal democracies in America and the rest of the world. The rebels called themselves anarchists.
In the media and general commentary, the term anarchy is used to indicate chaos, bomb-throwing, disruption, criminality. The actual meaning of the term is quite different. It involves mutual aid, cooperation, as close as you can get to pure democracy, real popular control over all institutions, sometimes resistance, usually leaderless resistance. That's partly ignorance and partly a way to undermine efforts to try to achieve a cooperative society with popular control, which of course is obviously very much opposed by elite interests.
From the 1997 film Living Utopia. When it came to getting anything from the store, then naturally one had to have that particular capacity and that way of thinking. Why would you take 4 pounds of meat today if 2 pounds is enough for you and tomorrow you can get more? Or a suit or a pair of shoes. Light, water, school, everything was free. You didn't have to pay for anything. There was no selfishness. Selfishness didn't exist. How could it? When there's no money, there's no selfishness. You say it today, and people don't understand, but everybody adapted very well. When the collective was formed, you know, when it was created, the vast majority of people accepted it easily. And they weren't all union people or anarchists. There was a big blackboard in the union office, and any worker who had a complaint would write it on the blackboard, and it would be discussed in the assembly. If a person suggested something, it was to find out what others thought, and if they would accept that proposal. If people agreed, fine. If not, they'd do something else. But always by consensus. We didn't govern ourselves because the regional committee said so. Every people has its culture, and because of that, it has its customs. The customs we have here in Valencia aren't the same as those in Andalusia. They're different. You have to be aware that you're working for yourself. You don't have a boss, so you're more keen to work. That way of behaving ethically in society, without the need for any police force. I think that self-management continues to be the great unresolved question.
How do the liberal democracies respond? Well, exactly as you'd expect them to. They despise democracy for very good reasons. The masters do not want the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders to run their own affairs, because they'll do it at their own interest. And you lose hierarchy and domination and centralized control and all the values that the masters naturally want. So the liberal democracies essentially joined forces with the fascists and the communists to destroy the revolution. After they destroyed the anarchist social revolution, then they started fighting among themselves. But the first task for the first year was to make sure that the popular revolution was crushed. And of course, the communists were in fact in the lead. And the fascists, of course, had their own interests. The United States was a little bit marginal at that time. It wasn't the major world power. It was mostly England and France. But Roosevelt also played a role. So there was an embargo passed, which prevented arms from going to the Republic. However, Roosevelt tolerated breaking of the embargo illegally to provide oil to the fascists. The State Department pretended it didn't know. Of course, they did know. I remember this as a child. The left-wing press was reporting it. The government said they never heard about it. And of course, the media went along with the government. Years later, the documents came out, and they conceded it had been happening all along. So yes, Roosevelt was basically supporting the fascists, but primarily destroying the anarchist revolution, which was a real threat.
A totalitarian state will reign in Spain. The functioning of all capacities and energies of the country, in which, inside the nation's unity, the work, considered as the least avoidable duty, will be the only exponent of the popular will, thanks to which the authentic power of the Spanish people will become manifest through those natural structures which, like the family, the city council, the association, and the corporation, will strengthen in reality our supreme ideal. Michael Parenti, historian.
Fascism is a very rational system. It is a instrument by the ruling plutocracy to distract the people with the accoutrements of a false revolution. There's always a false populism, and there's a lot of goose-stepping, and there's a lot of manipulation of symbols and sentiments and love of the state and the like. Much of politics is the rational use of irrational symbols. So fascism, the attention that when people study Italian fascism or Nazism especially, they focus on it as a kind of insane movement that just happened, carried on by this maniac Adolf Hitler, and the Germans were just went out of their heads and were led astray. In fact, what they tried to do is direct the real grievances of the German people toward irrelevant enemies.
Die Parteien versprachen den Himmel auf Erden.
And when the fascists came into power, they cut wages by 50%, they destroyed every labor union, they destroyed every opposition party and every newspaper, closed them down. They abolished all inheritance taxes for the rich or cut them drastically. They abolished all cartel taxes for the corporations. Pretty much what's being done here, without having to go politically all that far. So fascism is an instrument whereby the plutocracy can control and hopefully affect a final solution to the class struggle. You totally shatter and destroy and enslave the working class, and people just have to take it. What substantiates what I just said, that fascism is an instrument of the plutocracy, is the way the plutocracy acted toward the fascists. Not just the German plutocracy, which gave Hitler enormous sums of money, which enabled him to go all over the country, but also the plutocracy of the United States, where all sorts of eminent members of that plutocracy openly supported the fascists.
He gave Auburn Industries, Allgemeine Elektricität Gesellschaft, Siemens Schuckenberg, Siemens Halske, Opel, Free Group Antigesellschaft, Tokyo Shibaura, Mitsubishi Electrical Engineering Company, Westinghouse Electric Company of Japan, Compagnia Generale di Elettricità, Magrini Società Anonima, and many more all over the world.
Among the titans of Wall Street, there was a tremendous amount of sympathy for Adolf Hitler and for Mussolini, coupled with a great deal of fear about what they perceived as a rising red threat and the threat from unions. So they were largely sympathetic with what they saw going on over there. And of course, these people and the attorneys working for them, like the Dulles brothers, who would later go on to run the State Department and the CIA, were very much in tune on this sort of thing. Put them in an awkward position, of course, later on when they ended up having to fight against Hitler. But that never really, I think, changed their fundamental belief, which was that they shared common cause with industrialists everywhere. In fact, many of these people were involved with companies that had operations in Germany and in occupied territories of Germany. We later saw the prosecution of a number of them under the Trading with the Enemy Act, and this included Prescott Bush, the grandfather of George W. Bush.
Prescott Bush was a partner in Brown Brothers Harriman, the most prestigious investment bank on Wall Street. At a time when the influence of the WASP establishment in America, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, was near its peak.
Not only did some of the most powerful corporations support fascism in Europe, so did many of its most powerful politicians. Mussolini was frequently praised by leading political figures in the United States and Britain, and even by Churchill himself. On January 20th, 1927, he lauded the new philosophy while on a trip to Italy. "I will say a word on an international aspect of fascism," Churchill stated. "Externally, your movement has rendered a service to the whole world. Italy has shown that there is a way of fighting the subversive forces which can rally the masses of the people, properly led, to value and wish to defend the honor and stability of civilized society." It was only when fascist states began threatening Anglo-American interests that the philosophy fell out of favor, at least temporarily. Working-class men and boys from around the world were now forced to either defend or combat the Frankenstein monster nurtured by elites within their own nations. The nightmare of World War II had begun.
President Harry Truman, speaking on May the 8th, 1948.
"General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe."
Despite rhetoric to the contrary, Truman would support fascist and other totalitarian leaders across the globe. Republican Senator George Bender lamented that "Mr. Truman has urged the Congress to authorize a program of military collaboration with all the petty and not-so-petty dictators of South America." Progressive politician Henry Wallace went further. He stated that "bipartisan reactionary war policy would eventually lead to outright fascism in the United States itself." According to Wallace, the Cold War would lead to a century of fear.
End of part one. The second part begins with a quote from Alex Carey. "The 20th century has been characterized by three developments of great political importance: the growth of democracy, the growth of corporate power, and the growth of corporate propaganda as a means of protecting corporate power against democracy." And the film shows some credits from a black and white film, Communism. Copyright Coronet Instructional Films.
This is the Kremlin, citadel of Russian communism. Looking at Russia, we might see it as a country to be studied, as we study other nations of the world. Yet we know that Russia today is regarded as a grave threat to our nation, to our freedom, to the peace of the world. Why so? What makes it a threat? Looking closer, we see a clue. Public display of giant portraits of communist leaders. These leaders, by their actions, have caused the world to stand guard. Here, in Russia, you see the reason why so many nations are building up their defenses. Here, in Russia, you see the reason why we are spending billions of dollars in defense production. Why your family is paying the highest taxes in our history. The leaders of Russia tell us their only concern is the defense of their own nation. Is this so? Or are they ambitious for world conquest?
Produced in collaboration with the Defense Department, it is one of thousands of propaganda reels created during the Cold War to mold the opinions of the American people. According to the dominant narrative, the Soviet Union was engaged in a massive conspiracy run out of the Kremlin. The goal, world domination. In light of this threat, the United States had no choice but to counter the Soviet menace with massive military spending and constant interventions in the internal politics of sovereign states around the world. In Iran, Prime Minister Mossadegh was overthrown in a coup d'etat after nationalizing oil reserves. In Guatemala, Jacobo Arbenz suffered a similar fate after engaging in land reform and supporting union rights. In the Congo, Patrice Lumumba was overthrown and executed after initially coming to the United States for help. In Grenada, the New Jewel movement was removed from power after military intervention. And in Chile, the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende was overthrown and replaced with a dictatorship. The interventions continued. In the Dominican Republic, the CIA overthrew the democratically elected Juan Bosch. Bosch had written a liberal constitution pledging support for unions, women, and the homeless. In Brazil, a CIA-backed coup overthrew the democratically elected labor government of João Goulart. As a contingency plan, the U.S. drew up a scheme to provide a naval task force to intimidate Goulart supporters. In Bolivia, a CIA-backed military coup overthrew the leftist president Juan Torres. He was replaced by dictator Hugo Banzer, who banned all political parties and began a regime of torture and murder. In Argentina, the U.S. backed a military junta led by Jorge Rafael Videla, which went on to commit massive atrocities. In El Salvador, a U.S.-backed junta killed tens of thousands of civilians.
The infiltration into the Americas by terrorists, by outside interference, and those who aren't just aiming at El Salvador, but I think are aiming at the whole of Central and possibly later South America, and I'm sure eventually North America.
Pisado, hijo de puta.
His name was Bishop Romero. Unlike so many Christian leaders, he took seriously the idea that you cannot serve both God and money, and that it is the duty of every Christian to help uplift the poor. He was murdered by U.S.-backed forces on March 24, 1980. Not content with murdering Romero, the death squads detonated a bomb at his funeral. During the carnage, military aid by the United States was suspended for 1 month following the rape and murder of four American nuns. Then it was resumed.
The question is, why are we supporting El Salvador?
No, the question was, why are we killing priests in El Salvador?
The answer is, we're not. Now, you be quiet.
President Christiani is trying to do a job for democracy, and the left-wing guerrillas must not take over El Salvador.
The most notorious intervention by the Reagan administration occurred in Nicaragua, where U.S. intelligence created the Contra Army.
Correct, Mr. Secord, that from December 1984 until July 1985, you were engaged in selling arms to the Contras for profit.
That's correct.
Prior to the rise of the Sandinistas, members of the same family had ruled Nicaragua for over 40 years. The Somoza clan had monopolized almost every industry in the country, stealing millions from their own people. When Anastasio Somoza II was finally overthrown and fled to Miami, a U.S. intelligence report placed his net worth at nearly $100 million. Anastasio had been a particularly sadistic ruler. One of his favorite methods of execution was to throw dissidents from helicopters into the Masaya volcano. In 1979, the people revolted. The Sandinistas undertook radical reforms. They established the first public education system for children, building thousands of schools and playgrounds. They cut illiteracy to less than 10% of the population. They cut infant mortality by a third. They established a national health service. They abolished the death penalty. They allowed the development of independent cooperatives, increasing food production by over 100%. And they enjoyed the support of the vast majority of Nicaragua's people.
This revolution was not made by a proletariat party. It was produced by a popular insurrection. Everybody took part in the destruction of the dictatorship. This is not a political party. It's a front who made the revolution. And you have in this front different parties, the Socialist Party, the Christian Democratic Party, the Liberals, the Conservatives, all of them took part in this insurrection. Christians, the same time with Marxists, took part in this insurrection. The church, many priests and nuns supported the insurrection, even fought in the insurrection.
After a study of 76 developing countries, Oxfam stated that Nicaragua was exceptional in the strength of that government's commitment to improving the condition of the people and encouraging their active participation in the development process. But it was not to last. Fearing that the Sandinista model may spread to other countries, former Treasury Secretary George Shultz called the Sandinistas a cancer right here on our landmass. Trained in neighboring Honduras as well as back home in Florida, the Contras would unleash a reign of terror on the people of Nicaragua. They focused heavily on economic targets. Missions included the blowing up of oil pipelines, the illegal mining of Nicaraguan ports, the burning and bombing of grain silos, farmhouses, and machinery, and numerous other wanton attacks. It is possible that the Nicaraguan people may have been able to withstand these assaults, but the brutality of the Contras took its toll.
So I guess in a way they are counter-revolutionary, and God bless them for being that way. And I guess that makes them Contras, and so it makes me a Contra too. As long as there is breath in this body, I will speak and work, strive and struggle for the cause of the Nicaraguan freedom fighters.
A later Congressional Intelligence Committee revealed that the Contras had raped, tortured, and killed unarmed civilians, including children, and that groups of civilians, including women and children, were burned, dismembered, blinded, and beheaded.
There was an election here in Nicaragua in 1984, and I think most people have probably forgotten that, because there was some a brilliant piece of agenda setting up in Washington, whereby they suddenly decided that the Sandinistas were getting MiGs into the country. And although the entire press corps down here knew that this wasn't true, because it had been announced in Washington, we were all obliged by our foreign editors and news desks to go running up to the port and investigate the arrival of these mythical and non-existent MiGs. And the whole election coverage was abandoned. So everybody had covered the entire campaign, but everybody ceased to cover the election itself because Washington very cleverly changed the issue from the issue of democracy in Nicaragua to the issue of national security.
From the ABC program Timeline from the 11th, 7th, 84.
The United States has circumstantial evidence suggesting that as many as a dozen Soviet MiG-21 jets may have arrived today at the Nicaraguan port of Corinto.
Part 2. Propaganda.
Following World War II, American policy planners were faced with a choice: to embrace democracy in all its forms, or suppress huge populations around the globe through violence. The first major test came from Greece. Rejecting the participatory government created by the anti-Nazi resistance during the war, both the British and Americans chose to support fascist elements that the resistance had been fighting only months before. The resulting civil war caused over 100,000 deaths. Though seldom acknowledged in official histories, Western elites had long supported fascism in Europe as a means of counteracting the left.
Do you think we're going to win this war against Russian communism?
Yes, I'm an American, Mr. Hazlitt. I'm not very good at being a pessimist. We can't afford to do anything which isn't honorable. The honor comes before peace, it comes before victory, it comes before anything else.
There's some color footage of the U.S. bombing villages in Laos in 1966.
For many American leaders, as well as military and intelligence officers, the Soviet Union and the philosophy of communism were seen as real existential threats. According to Philip Agee, one of the first CIA whistleblowers, the reading list at the farm, an advanced training facility for CIA officers, consisted almost entirely of critical books about the Soviet Union. Notably absent was any literature dealing with democratic or libertarian socialism, or any text written by socialists themselves. Not even Marx himself was part of the reading list. According to Agee, CIA recruits were taught that communist attempts to set up dictatorships around the world were really manifestations of Soviet expansion, which in turn was determined by the need to maintain power at home. Our country was the real target.
Christopher Simpson, author of The Science of Coercion.
One of the most interesting things about propaganda is the relationship between what the propagandist believes and what he or she has to say. What we see is a system of propaganda in which the main propagandists believe what they're saying. They believe in what they're doing, or acting for the greater good of humanity, or whatever their particular cause is. And what happens in that kind of circumstance is a phenomenon that some people call blowback. In other words, you come up with messages that are aimed at ideologies or worldviews, and you put them out. And then the messages come back to you as though they were truthful. Wars in particular, but self-destructive actions of all sorts. When the public sits back and looks at it later, they say, you know, they'll ask yourself, how did they get into this foolishness? Well, part of it is this cycle of self-deception.
Ralph McGeehy, former CIA officer.
When I joined the agency, I was a dedicated cold warrior who felt the agency was out there fighting for liberty, justice, democracy, and religion around the world. And I believed wholeheartedly in this. I just felt proud every day that I went to work, because I was out at the vanguard of the battle against the international evil empire, international communist evil empire.
If the overriding belief system cultivated amongst foot soldiers was that the Soviet Union was fanatically imperialist, others were more skeptical. Speaking of the claim that Soviet Russia was determined to conquer the world, Republican Senator Robert Taft remarked that no Russian military attack is threatened in Western Europe. I certainly do not pretend to understand the Russian mind, but for 4 years they have shown no intention of making a military advance beyond the zones of influence in Central Europe allotted to them at Yalta. History would prove Taft correct. While occasionally lending token support to liberation movements in the Third World, Soviet foreign policy would remain remarkably conservative throughout the Cold War.
William Bloom, historian.
The Soviet Union, contrary to what all Americans were taught, was not a revolutionary society at home or abroad. After the initial overthrow of the Tsar and of the capitalist system, they settled into a very conservative pattern. They fought against change. Their main concern was to be on good terms with the West, which would surprise most Americans. But being on good terms with the West was what they wanted. They wanted to pursue what was known as socialism in one country, not expanding it. This is Stalin now, and who was in charge. Trotsky thought otherwise. That's why he had this great dispute with Stalin, and he lost that internal battle, and that's why he was forced into exile. About the Cold War, one must keep this in mind. We're taught it was a struggle between the United States and the Soviet Union. I maintain that that's fallacious. The Cold War was a struggle between the United States and the Third World. That's who they were fighting against, the native left-wing forces who were agitating for very radical change. The Soviet Union, in almost all cases, played either no role whatsoever in these scenarios or a very insignificant role. Whatever they did was highly exaggerated by the Western media.
Howard Zinn, historian.
The world communist conspiracy, the Soviet Union was not in a position to bring communism around the world. There were people in their own countries who wanted communist revolutions. The Soviet Union was not behind they didn't start the revolution in Cuba. They didn't start the revolution in Vietnam. They didn't start the revolution in China. They didn't start revolutionary movements around the world. No. Revolutionary movements came out of the needs of people in those countries. They created revolutionary movements, and when they created revolutionary movements, all of this was attributed to the Soviet Union. And so when the people in Vietnam created their own nationalist movement, first against the French, then the United States, oh well, this was seen, or portrayed, I should say, by the American elite, which I think understood this was not a part of a world communist conspiracy. Well, they may have justified it to themselves that way, but they also knew something else, and they said it in their secret memos, which were all revealed if you read the Pentagon Papers, you know, the secret defense history of the Vietnam War. Their real intent was, well, to have a base in Vietnam, a base that would be near all the rich, the tin, the rubber, and oil, the rich resources of that area of Southeast Asia, and also to have another military base in the world. Their motives were not given to the American people, but their motives were clear, and the motives really had nothing to do with a world communist conspiracy, but with economic and military power.
Lying. Dirty.
Its goal of world conquest.
Shrewd. Godless.
Its insidious tactics.
Murderous. Determined.
And its cunning strategy.
It's an international criminal conspiracy.
Numerous internal documents from the State Department, the Defense Department, the CIA, and other Western intelligence services reveal that many top policy planners were well aware that the international communist conspiracy was a myth. One such document, speaking of American designs against Syria, notes that the USSR has shown no intention of direct intervention in any of the previous Mideastern crises, and we believe it is unlikely that they would intervene. Another declassified document, this from the British Foreign Office Joint Intelligence Committee, states that the Soviet Union will not deliberately start general war or even limited war in Europe, and that Soviet foreign policy had been cautious and realistic.
There were so many suspicions on both sides. The West exaggerated the strength of the Soviet Union. We could not possibly have moved into Europe. We were a devastated country. We'd lost millions of people.
Despite popular belief, post-war doves in the United States were not limited to leftists. Among the advocates in non-interventionism were conservative and libertarian figures that foresaw in the Truman Doctrine a dangerous ideology that would lead to massive empire and self-destruction. Yet the voices of these men and women were a minority, and there were far more powerful interests with a seat at Truman's side. One of these was Charles E. Wilson, the president of General Electric Corporation. GE had garnered enormous profits during World War II, and Charlie Wilson saw no reason why the prospect of peace should interfere with his prerogative. He suggested what he called a permanent war economy.
it was only one of the General Electric network, employing 125,000 workers. Westinghouse employed 75,000. General Motors Electrical Division, 25,000.
Echoing Wilson's sentiments was a chorus of voices in the corporate media. Business Week spoke of military spending as a way to maintain a generally upward tone and inject new strength into the entire economy. On June 25, 1950, President Truman signed National Security Council Document 68. It would not be released to the public for 25 years, but its contents are illuminating.
There's a quote from Cicero, "Endless money forms the sinews of war." Philip Agee, former CIA officer.
Military expenditures in the United States are the motor of the U.S. economy, and they have been that ever since about 1950. It's worth reviewing the history because that's where this crisis, I think, comes from, this sought-for, needed crisis. In early 1950, there was extreme worry at the highest levels of the Truman administration that the United States was likely to return to the conditions of the Great Depression of the 1930s. And so early in 1950, the decision was taken that this domestic economic problem was going to be solved through militarism, that is, through rearmament in the United States and through U.S. financing of the rearmament of Western Europe, particularly Western Germany. The document which provides the analysis of the world at that time and the U.S. place in the world and the internal situation in the United States was top secret for 25 years. In 1975, it was accidentally or through error released and published. It is known as NSC 68. It was written by NSC, standing for National Security Council. It was written by Paul Nitze, and it is a very detailed document. The main operative conclusion, though, was this. This is a quote from the document. "The United States and other free nations will, within a period of a few years at most, experience a decline in economic activity of serious proportions unless more positive governmental programs are developed." Well, the solution adopted those more positive governmental programs was expansion of the military. He mustered all the hype and emotion he could, and Truman said, among other things, he said, "Our homes, our nation, all the things that we believe in are in great danger. This danger has been created by the rulers of the Soviet Union." In his speech, he also called for massive increases in military spending for U.S. and European forces, quite apart from the needs in Korea. Well, there was no threat from the Soviet Union. They were still rebuilding from the rubble of World War II, in which they had lost 20 million people. They were no threat, but they were manufactured from 1950 on, from the time of Korea on, as a grave threat to the United States. And that became the justification for this program, which Truman, through manipulation of the Korean War, had been able finally to get through Congress. The result was that in the first 2 years, that is, the 2 years between 1950 and 1952, the U.S. military budget more than tripled from $13 billion in 1950 to $44 billion in 1952. And during the same two-year period, U.S. military forces doubled to 3.6 million people under arms. This was the beginning of the permanent war economy in the United States. The Korean War, by the way, went on for three more years after it could have ended. In the end, 34,000 U.S. were dead, more or less, more than 100,000 wounded, and the total casualty count was in the millions. It is worth recalling that because from 1950 on, the Soviet threat was the justification. The justification for the permanent war economy and the justification for these enormous military expenditures.
2 decades after NSC 68, 15 giant corporations would swallow up two-thirds of the $40 billion a year spent on the Pentagon. 5 decades later, the armament industry would take up over 50% of all discretionary spending. The Pentagon system came to function not only as a means of waging war, but as a Keynesian mechanism designed to transfer public wealth to private industry.
Noam Chomsky,
The myth of the free market is a very interesting kind of mythology. I'll take the U.S. economy because it's the dominant one, but more or less the same everywhere. The U.S. economy relies crucially on the dynamic state sector. Where we're sitting, MIT, it's almost impossible to miss. I mean, things like, say, computers and the internet, complicated software, information technology, lasers, microelectronics, pharmaceuticals, it's developed at MIT and places like this under government funding. That means at taxpayer expense. And it's for long periods. I mean, computers and the internet are supposed to be at the heart of the high-tech economy now. They were in the public sector for about 30 years before they were handed over to private enterprise to make profit from. Bill Gates, he was living off of public funding. The basic structure of software, computers, internet, and so on was developed, and he managed to use it to create a quasi-monopoly. The role of entrepreneurial initiative and consumer choice is virtually nothing except at the marketing end. The same is true of the pharmaceutical industries and so on. Actually, at MIT, you see it very strikingly. In the 50s and the 60s, MIT was almost completely funded by the Pentagon. It's not because it was doing war work. It's because it was creating the basis of the future economy. And the Pentagon understands that. So public funds are channeled to research and development for ultimate profit under the pretext that it's to defend ourselves. So therefore, the public pays the cost. The way the system works is cost and risk are socialized. That's for the public. Profit is privatized. That's a very convenient system, and it's called the free market.
Nancy Snow, author of Propaganda, Inc.
You have to really think about what happened most recently with the 2008, the beginning of sort of the meltdown of the American economy. What ultimately happened is that we took care of those who were driving business interests. We took care of Wall Street on the backs of Main Street. So we continue to do this today because we have bought in. We have really persuaded ourselves that it's business that is the most protected sector. And in many respects, they're allowed to make
mistakes. That's where we have to leave
the
film Speak on Grounds of Time. If you'd like to know more about the Cold War, this is only the latest of 5 episodes we've made on the Cold War. To find the other ones, go to this show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/640, scroll down and click on the category Cold War, and it'll bring up a list. And similarly, if you're interested in imperialism or Iran or any of the other categories to which this episode belongs, you can similarly click and bring up a list of the other episodes. The show has a Twitter feed at twitter.com/unwelcomeguests, and there's a mailing list if you're interested in discussing the show or if you have a radio station that broadcasts it. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Now, I've been quite an unwelcome guests evangelist in my time, burning copies to discs, giving them out to friends and strangers. Old statistician that I am, I discovered earlier this month we crossed 1 million page views and 250,000 page views on the cover page, which has taken 2.5 years. But, okay, we haven't had any advertising, so it's all been word of mouth. So, if you're one of those people who've been pointing other people to the show, then I appreciate that. We're getting more visitors on the web than ever before. I appreciate all your emails and suggestions, ideas, and help in making this show what it is.